expensive altar. Brother Jerry.
Thank you, Brother Dave. It's a pleasure to be back in the Pacific Northwest, and it's been way too long. I was a member of the Seattle class from 79 to 81, and I was in the Portland class from 77 to 79. And I was just talking about this with Dave. You know, I've been in Milwaukee for 14 years, and I love the Milwaukee class dearly, but the years that I was here in the Northwest were so had such an impact on my walk and my faith and the lessons that I learned here in Seattle and down in Portland, up in Montana, were so strong that I feel really anchored in this part of the country, even though it was a short time and a long time ago. I've never been anywhere where I had that kind of experience before, and part of what I am now is a result of those experiences. And along with that, it seems like my experiences with the Northwest continue. When I got to the airport yesterday to check in, I was told that my flight had been canceled. I was supposed to fly United through Chicago and then out here. And they had called everybody that had four or five seats, like families, but they hadn't been able to get to the people that were just reserving a single flight. So the poor woman behind the counter scrambled around and managed to get me a flight on Northwest. Well, 16 years ago, when Debbie and I were getting married, we had the most awful experience with Northwest you can imagine. We had flown back from the retirement center to Milwaukee for our wedding, and then on the way back, it just turned into a total disaster, complete. So when I do searches on the web, I don't even click on Northwest. When I consider flying, I don't even look at Northwest, and for years, we referred to them as Northwest. So here I am, standing in front of the ticket agent at United, and she says, "We have found a flight for you on Northwest, and you need to come over here, and they'll take care of you," because the flight was leaving in about 20 minutes. So I went over, and I got in the line, and people were trying to figure out their automatic kiosk that you're supposed to do your check-in with. And, of course, we're mostly all computer illiterate, no matter what they tell us. And so she finally said, "Excuse me, are you from United?" I said, "Yes, I am." She says, "You need to come up here now." So they got me checked in. They got me out. And the flight was terrific. The flight just went without a hitch. They were full airplanes, jam-packed. President Bush had been in Milwaukee yesterday, actually in West Dallas, where we live. And so the person in front of me was a CIA agent with a dog. He was going to the next facility that the president was going to by way of commercial carrier. And so it was wonderful. And somewhere during that trip, I heard this small voice say to me, "Don't you think it's time to let go of your grudge?" I thought, there's the Lord talking to me again about going to the Northwest. Yeah, I've been carrying this grudge against Northwest. Maybe it's time to let it be put to rest. I want to bring you the love and greetings of Debbie. Especially, we would have liked to have had her out here and the kids out here, and as it turned out, they probably wouldn't have been able to find four more seats to put us on, so it's probably best that it was like that. But they sent their love and greetings. The kids, of course, were disappointed that they couldn't come, but they send their love as well. And your brethren in Milwaukee send their love and greetings. We were talking a little bit at lunch. Some of us, we've had some experiences in Milwaukee. We've had some pass away, and we've also had some differences arise over our next study. About 2 years ago, we completed a study and went into the next one. And there were some questions about whether it should be Bible study or volume study, all those types of things. And that was kind of a rough time for us. But we'll get through it, and okay. So in the process of that, I just once again started thinking about how we relate to each other and how we get along and whether we carry grudges, and how special we are as Bible students, as the Lord's family. I want you to think of the scripture in John 16:27 that says, "The Father himself loves you." The Father himself loves you. And in John 6:44, we read, "No one can come to Jesus unless the Father draws him." This means for us that God has seen something very special in each and every one of us, and he desires to have it. The great Creator is bringing forth a new creation to be His special treasure. And each of us has been called to a very unique position. In 1 Corinthians 12, Paul gives us that wonderful picture of the body and its many members working together, yet with great diversity. And lest we forget, he stresses in verse 18, God has placed the members, each one of them, in the body just as He desired. Each of us has a special talent and is given opportunities and blessings through the Spirit, just as He, that is God, wills. Paul's words in verse 11. Through these very special experiences, we bring forth fruitage, some a hundredfold, some 60, some 30. Matthew 13:23. Yet all are not the same. God knows that, and He cherishes us, each and every one of us, for exactly what we are. For most of us, He alone can see the treasure beneath the dross. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart, 1 Samuel 16:7. 144,000 members compose the body, each bringing his or her special service to it. Most of us who would be of the bride have little or nothing in common save the truth in the Lord. If it wasn't for the blessed tie that binds our hearts in Christian love, as the hymn so beautifully expresses it, few of us would ever even cross paths. We come from all walks of life, from various backgrounds, different regions, different countries, different times. Yet as Paul says, from now on, we recognize no man according to the flesh, 2 Corinthians 5:16. We are brethren. We have become family. We share in the same precious blood, that of our Savior. We dress alike. We wear the robe of righteousness. We have the same goal and heart's desire to please our Heavenly Father and to honor Him and glorify His name. And we can only do that according to the talent that we each have. We can only use the gifts He has given us. We can't be something we aren't. And we don't need to be. For God chose us according to what we have to offer. We can share our offering with one another. Have you ever wondered why Paul admonishes us against neglecting to meet together? We heard about this morning. Hebrews 10:25. It's because we have so much to offer one another. He tells us to consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds and encourage one another. And just as our Father in heaven delights in us, we can delight in one another. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor, Romans 12:10. We can learn from one another, for each child of God is unique and very, very special. Seeing then that our family consists of so many unique and specially talented members, we may expect that our devotion to the Lord, the truth, and the brethren will find expression in many varied forms. Some will have much zeal in witnessing activities, others in edifying the body members. Many are meticulous students of prophecy, while others tend toward admonishing. There are varieties of ministries, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 12:5, and varieties of effects. But the same God who works all things in all persons. Verse 6. So what does this variety mean for you and me? It means we will seek to abound for the edification of the church. 1 Corinthians 14:12. All that we do should be with the intent that each body member may receive a blessing. And if we will look for it, we can receive a blessing from each and every one. This is the ideal, that all body members should love one another, build one another up, that there should be no division in the body. The members should have the same care for one another. 1 Corinthians 12:25. The reality, unfortunately, is something less. There are divisions in the body, not only in the classes, but also between individual members. We misunderstand one another, or we overreact to situations or circumstances. Our old nature, though reckoned dead, is very much alive and terribly combative. And with so much diversity among the brethren, we do not need to look far to find something or someone with whom to be contentious. After all, consider your calling. God has chosen the foolish, the weak, the base, that no man should boast before God. 1 Corinthians 1:26 to 29. Is it any wonder then that we become argumentative, impatient, less than sympathetic with each other, especially when we do not really understand what is being said or done? This is not in any way meant to condone or excuse such attitudes and actions. Divisions anywhere among the brethren are like divorce, which Jesus said was the result of hardness of heart in Mark 10:5. Likewise, we cannot justify separation with, well, he or she left me. Because we must ask ourselves, how did I drive them away? However, we can anticipate that these things will occur. We will say and do things at times that are taken in the wrong spirit, just as we will misunderstand others. Peter anticipated this when he asked the Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Matthew 18:21. The Lord also knew that there would be times when we would be out of harmony, and he gave us the prescription to remedy that problem. Matthew 18:15-17. The procedure begins with going to the individual in order that we might win them back. Chances are they are completely unaware that we feel a wrong has been committed. Perhaps only if our pride was hurt, or our preference was overruled. However, it cannot be resolved if we do not talk to one another. From there, as we all know, the matter is taken before witnesses, and then finally the church, if need be, is to be resolved. Always keep in mind that the intention of this procedure is to win back our brethren, that the body might be whole and grow together in love. I know very few times when this procedure has been used, but when it has been successfully, many blessings have resulted. We must at least be willing to try, for we have much to lose should even one child fall, and much to gain in winning our brethren back. A wonderful illustration of this principle and spirit of Matthew 18 can be found in Israel's experience. As the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness were drawing to an end, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take full vengeance for the sons of Israel on the Midianites. This is in Numbers 31, verses 1 and 2. So Moses gathered 1,000 men from each of the 12 tribes and sent them to war. The remainder of Numbers 31 describes their victory and the booty which they captured. A portion of the booty was given for the Lord, and the remainder was divided up among the 12 tribes. Israel's wealth came from the spoils of war which God gave to them. We want to remember this point. What Israel had came from God, just as what we possess comes from God, be it natural things or spiritual things. Now in Numbers 32:1 we read, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad had an exceeding large number of livestock. Remember, this was from the Lord. Continuing, when they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, it was indeed a place suitable for livestock. So they approached Moses and Eleazar and the leaders, saying, the land which the Lord conquered before the congregation of Israel is a land for livestock, and your servants have livestock. If we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants as a possession. Do not take us across the Jordan. Numbers 32:1-5. Here we see that the tribes of Reuben and Gad have been given cattle by the Lord, and in order to make the best use of this gift, they have found land that is most suitable to their needs. They are asking Moses and the leaders to allow them to satisfy their own need. They don't want to go in the same direction as the rest of the people. They don't want to go into Canaan. They want to use the land that God has given them on the east side of the Jordan. Have you ever wanted to take a different direction from your brethren? To do something different? Or have you ever known someone who wanted to go in a different direction to do something different in the Lord's service? What was your reaction? What response did you get? Let's look at Moses' response and see if there's any similarities. Numbers 32:6, Moses says, "Shall your brothers go to war while you yourselves sit here? Are you discouraging the sons of Israel from crossing over into the land which the Lord has given them?" Another way this might be asked is, "Are you trying to keep us from doing what we perceive to be God's will for us? Are you withdrawing your help and support from your brethren?" Remember, as Moses points out in the next six verses, this is why Israel had wandered in the wilderness all these 40 years. The spies had returned and discouraged their faith, and God was angry with them, and that entire generation passed away without seeing the land. Do we ever feel that our brethren are not supporting a decision we have made or a project that we would undertake? Is it discouraging? Have you ever been angered because someone wanted to do something different from what we are accustomed to doing? Moses even calls these two tribes a brood of sinful men in verse 14. How would we respond to that? In verses 16 to 19, we have their response. The tribes of Reuben and Gad would make provisions for their livestock and families, and then they assured Moses and the leaders that they would go before the sons of Israel until we have brought them to their place, and we will not return to our homes until every one of the sons of Israel has possessed his inheritance. How's that for support and encouragement? The men of Reuben and Gad would set aside their own work and go into the land and stay there as long as they were needed, and they were willing to fight side by side with their brethren, even though, as they said in verse 19, we will not have an inheritance with them on the other side of the Jordan and beyond, because our inheritance has fallen to us on this side of Jordan towards the east. There would be no gain for them except the blessing of being with their brethren, engaged in the Lord's work. Remember, verse 4 told us that the east side of the Jordan had also been given to them by the Lord. And in verse 22, Moses acknowledges that this land, speaking of the east side, shall be yours for a possession before the Lord. But Moses, like us, was a fallen man, and he wasn't certain that Gad and Reuben would keep their word. This he expresses in verse 23 when he says, "Even if you will not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out." It's often difficult to give way to others, especially when we are certain that our way is what we would call the Lord's will. Moses considered the matter and must have found it acceptable, for he gave command concerning them to Eleazar the priest and to Joshua, the son of Nun, and to the heads of the fathers' households of the tribe of the head of the sons of Israel, in verse 28. Moses must have still suspected their motives, for in verse 30 he goes on and says, "If they will not cross over with you armed, they shall have possession among you in the land of Canaan." Notice he did not say they would be cast out or left behind or forsaken. He said they would share in the blessing of the land of Canaan. No matter how skeptical or suspect we are of our brethren, we can never say they have no portion in the land. Only the Lord can remove a member of the family. We are never to make that judgment. The question may arise, how did the Lord look upon this decision? Well, apparently, he approved. For we read, The sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben answered, saying, "As the Lord has said to your servants, so we will do. The possession of our inheritance shall remain with us across," that is, the east side of the Jordan, verses 32 and 33. And what of Israel? What did the people of Israel think of this request by their brethren? We aren't told in this account. I would surmise only that their individual responses were about as varied as the people themselves. There were probably those who took offense, those who rejoiced, and those who took little thought of it. Each probably responded according to his or her heart. There was one group, we are told, that joined in with Reuben and Gad, and that was the half-tribe of Manasseh. Apparently, the arrangement was suitable to them also, because in verse 33, we read that a portion of the surrounding, we're told that the half-tribe of Manasseh was given a portion of the surrounding land. Can you imagine the feelings this must have evoked? Probably not so different from our own. The Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh had agreed to go into Canaan and fight to subdue the land with Israel. This they did, and they stayed until the land had been divided. Turn to Joshua 22. Beginning with verse 1, Joshua has called together the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. He commends them for keeping Moses' commandments, as well as his own, and testifies to their faithfulness, saying, "You have not forsaken your brothers these many days to this day, but have kept the charge of the commandment of the Lord your God." Verse 3. Joshua then releases them and sends them back to their inheritance, east of the Jordan, admonishing them to be very careful to observe the commandment and the law which Moses, the servants of the Lord, commanded, to love the Lord your God and walk in all his ways and keep his commandments and hold fast to him and serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. Verse 5. So what more could we ask of ourselves than to live up to these expectations to the best of our abilities? And he did not send them empty-handed. In verse 8, we read that they took with them great riches which they had taken from their enemies and which they were to share with their brothers. What a departure this must have been. For it was not only the tribes leaving, but also the family of Manasseh was splitting. Verse 7 tells us that the other half-tribe of Manasseh was given a portion of the land west of the Jordan. So the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh returned home and departed from the sons of Israel at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan, to go to the land of Gilead, to the land of their possession, which they had possessed, according to the command of the Lord through Moses. Verse 9. Let's not forget that the Lord had blessed this arrangement. It would be a blessing for all. We have the 2.5 tribes on one side of the Jordan, the remainder of the people on the other. They have these spoils that they've gathered in this war. As the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh were returning to Gilead, they came to the region of the Jordan, which is in the land of Canaan, and they built an altar there by the Jordan, a large altar in appearance. Verse 10. Continuing, "And the sons of Israel heard it. Behold, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar at the frontier of the land of Canaan in the region of the Jordan, on the side belonging to the sons of Israel. And when the sons of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel gathered themselves at Shiloh to go up against them in war." Verse 10 to 12. These are the same people that had left their homes and their families not so long ago to go to war with the Israelites. And now Israel is preparing for war against them because they have heard of this abomination. How many troubles among us have begun with, "I heard"? I heard. These 2.5 tribes had just been commended for their faithfulness And now that they had built an altar or had done something that the people had no previous knowledge of, all of their good was forgotten, and the people wanted to go to war with them. And they had done it in Israel's land. But it was all land that God had given them. Can you imagine, as this started to bubble up, as it started to come forth, the evil speaking, the surmisings that must have gone on? And why not? The Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh had built an altar. Who knows what they were going to do with it? Who knows what they were going to sacrifice on it? Hadn't Israel just driven out heathen nations who built altars to all kinds of gods and to offer living sacrifices? And wasn't the tabernacle the only proper place to bring offerings before the Lord? And after all, they had found the land on the east side of the Jordan more desirable, even though the Lord was leading Israel into Canaan. They should at least have built this monstrosity on their own land. Can you hear the discussion, the argument, the reasoning, the principles bannered around that this act generated? Can you imagine the outrage, the anger, the indignation that escalated the attacks until the people were finally brought to a state of preparing for war? Does any of this remind us of what has gone on among ourselves? It does indeed. At least the people of Israel had the good sense to send messengers to Gilead and speak to the tribe before war broke out. Though I'm sure some felt it was a waste of time or a show of being less faithful to principle. Return to the account, beginning with verse 15. They, that is, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, and 10 chiefs, or, as Lamson renders it in his translation, generals, come to the sons of Reuben, to the sons of Gad, to the half-tribe of Manasseh, to the land of Gilead, and they spoke with them, saying, "Thus says the whole congregation of the Lord." Notice, they spoke for the people, not God. What is this unfaithful act which you have committed against the God of Israel, turning away from following the Lord this day by building yourselves an altar to rebel against the Lord this day? The people had already decided this was an unfaithful act. It had been done against God. These tribes were rebelling against the Lord. Perhaps our modern phrase would be, they were going out of the truth. Is not the iniquity of Peor enough for us, from which we have not cleansed ourselves to this day? Although a plague came on the congregation of the Lord, that you must turn away this day from following the Lord? And it will come about, if you rebel against the Lord today, that he will be angry with the whole congregation of Israel tomorrow. Now we see that Israel was driven by fear. I think we can all appreciate that it is often our own fears and insecurities that make us act irrationally. We often lash out at the things we feel threaten us. Verse 19 also shows that few were willing to accept that these people, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, really were able to serve God and be blessed on the east side of the Jordan. It's as if the blessings came from the Lord and all flowed exclusively into Canaan. They stated, "If, however, the land of your possession is unclean, then cross into the land of the possession of the Lord." But remember, the Lord had given them the land on both sides of the Jordan, where the Lord's tabernacle stands, and take possession among us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, or rebel against us by building an altar for yourselves, besides the altar of the Lord our God. Do we ever feel that our way is the only way pleasing to the Lord? Do we feel we are exclusive, Picture in your mind the scene that's unfolding. The Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh have just been told they are unfaithful, they're rebellious, they're committing an abomination. The implication is that their land is unclean. The people whom they fought for are now preparing to make war against them. These are their own brethren. Israel has already judged the matter and is now trying to dissuade them from doing what they felt was right. How would you feel? What would be your response? What would you say? If I was this position, I think I'd be saying a lot. I'd be making my own judgments about my accusers. I don't think anything hurts us more than to be told we are not devoted to and serving our God. Even Jesus' most severe test was to be tried and executed as a blasphemer. But we must rise above this impulse to judge, to lash out, and we have a wonderful, wonderful example in the response of these tribes to Phinehas and the 10 leaders. In verse 21 we read, "Then the sons of Reuben, the sons of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh answered and spoke to the heads of the families of Israel." Quoting, "The Mighty One, God the Lord, the Mighty One, God the Lord, He knows, and may Israel itself know, if it was in rebellion, or if in an unfaithful act against the Lord, do not thou save us this day. If we have built us an altar to turn away from following the Lord, or if to offer a burnt offering or grain offering on it, or if to offer sacrifices of peace offerings on it, may the Lord Himself require it." They wanted God to be their judge, for He alone can read the heart. We too should leave judgment with God. Continuing, "But truly, we have done this out of concern, for a reason, saying, in time to come, your sons may say to our sons, what have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? For the Lord has made the Jordan a border between us and you. You sons of Reuben and sons of Gad, you have no portion in the Lord. So your sons may make our sons stop fearing the Lord." Do you think this was a valid consideration? Do you think that in years to come, the people on the west side of the Jordan would disavow the people on the east side, though they be brethren? Have we seen similar experiences among ourselves? I think so. We tend to align ourselves with leaders or organizations or ecclesias. It's in our nature, and oftentimes we look with disdain upon those who are not of our fellowship. Yet we all have the same hope, the same goal, the same heart's desire. Our union is in the Spirit, not our circumstances. Continuing with verse 26, we read, "Therefore, we said, let us build an altar, not for burnt offering or for sacrifice. Rather, it shall be a witness between us and you, and between our generations after us, that we are to perform the service of the Lord before Him with our burnt offerings and with our sacrifices and with our peace offerings, that your sons may not say to our sons in time, you have no portion in the Lord. Therefore we said, it shall also come about, if they say this to us or to our generations in time to come, we will say, see the copy of the altar of the Lord, which our fathers made, not for burnt offering or for sacrifice. Rather, it is a witness between us and you. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn away from following the Lord this day by building an altar for burnt offering, for grain offering, or for sacrifice, besides the altar of the Lord our God, which is before His tabernacle. The sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the sons of Manasseh had not been unfaithful. It had not occurred to them to dishonor the Lord. They were striving to maintain unity among all of God's people and to honor His name. There was an act, this was an act motivated by love and faith and trust in God, for they wanted their families to always serve Him. So when Phinehas, the priest, and the leaders of the congregation, even the heads of the families of Israel who were with him, heard the words which the son of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the sons of Manasseh spoke, it pleased them. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, said to the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the sons of Manasseh, "Today we know that the Lord is in our midst, because you have not committed this unfaithful act against the Lord. Now you have delivered the sons of Israel from the hand of the Lord." Then Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, and the leaders returned from the sons of Reuben and from the sons of Gad, from the land of Gilead to the land of Canaan, to the sons of Israel, and brought back word to them. And the word pleased the sons of Israel, and the sons of Israel blessed God. And they did not speak of going up against them in war, to destroy the land in which the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad were living. And the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad called the altar witness. For they said, "It is a witness between us that the Lord is God." Isn't that beautiful? What might have been a tragic misunderstanding turned into a glorious witness for our Heavenly Father. While Israel showed some error in judgment, their brethren were still able to come to terms with them, and the Lord God was glorified. As long as they continued to communicate, a solution was possible and unity was maintained. They still kept their autonomy, but their love of God united them. Our love for God and His dear Son can unite us also. We can begin to remove the barriers between ourselves and grow closer together. It's not an easy task, but nothing worthwhile is. It's imperative that we do it. Are there any we harbor ill feelings toward? Are there any in whose presence we find discontent? It's easy to make sweeping statements like, "I love my brethren," but do we really, on a personal, intimate level? Are there any of our brethren whom we would rather not see or deal with? If so, we have much work to do. Jesus said, "Everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court." If therefore you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and present your offering. Matthew 5:22-24. Once we've been reconciled, our love for each other can grow. Recall the wonderful blessing you experience when you're together. Imagine how empowering it can be to know that you can be anything, say anything, with that person who's your best friend, secure in that love. If we could carry that experience of that special friend into all of our relationships, we could truly abound. If we can build one another up, encourage one another, support each other in serving the truth and the brethren, what glory we could show forth to our Heavenly Father. And it starts right here. We must be willing to allow our brethren to grow and to change. We must look for a blessing instead of disagreement. And we must be kind and considerate and sensitive to each other's needs. We must not stifle creativity and self-expression. We are all unique. We are all special. And we bring our very different talents and abilities together for the blessing of all. Let us not judge one another anymore, but rather determine this, not to put an obstacle or stumbling block in a brother's way. Let love be without hypocrisy, and abhor that which is evil. Cling to what is good, and be devoted to one another in the brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor, not lagging behind in diligence, and be fervent in spirit, serving the Lord rejoicing, persevering in tribulation, devoted to prayer, and contributing to the needs of the saints. Rejoice with those who rejoice, and weep with those who weep, and be of the same mind toward one another, not haughty, but associate with the lowly. Be wise, not in your own estimation, and since we have gifts that differ, according to the grace given to us, let each exercise them accordingly. Romans 4:13 and 12:9-16. God bless you all.